Today's Access Utah program was first broadcast in October 2011. Jared Elias's latest novel in the Daniel Jacobus mystery series entitled Death and Transfiguration will be published in June.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. It's Music and Mystery on the program today. We're going to be talking with Gerald Elias, former associate concertmaster of the Utah Symphony. He was a Boston Symphony violinist and professor of music at the University of Utah, first violinist of the Abramian String Quartet, author you no doubt have heard of a series of now of mystery novels, the latest, Death and the Maiden. They're set in the world of classical music. The latest one, as the new Magini String Quartet prepares for a performance of Schubert's masterpiece, Death and the Maiden, which it hopes will resuscitate its faltering career. Two events occur. First, its former second violinist, Crispin Short, who had sued the ensemble when he was fired and publicly embarrassed, issues an ultimatum: reinstate me or I'll destroy you. Second, the manipulative first violinist, Aaron Kortovsky, is unaccountably missing in action. No one knows his whereabouts. And hero of the stories, Daniel Jacobus, is called in. Gerald Elias, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Access Utah.
Well, my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You, I believe, are on the tail end of some extensive touring for this book.
Yeah, you know, most summers I play with the Boston Symphony at their Tanglewood Music Festival in Massachusetts. And after that season ended, I had a four-week book tour that took me through the down the East Coast, across the South, and up the Southwest. So it was about 4 weeks of traveling from one bookstore to another, but it was very enjoyable.
Now, with the Abramian Quartet and with the Utah Symphony, I'm sure you did quite a bit, and a soloist, sure you did a lot of traveling. How's this different? Book tours, I guess the travel is the same, but there's some differences.
Well, certainly, you know, when you have a concert tour, you know, everything is all planned, and you go and you check in at your hotel, and you you know, get ready for your concerts. You have your rehearsals, and you know, those things can be pretty grueling too. I remember the European tour the Utah Symphony went on a few years ago to Europe. Very enjoyable tour, and hopefully they'll do it again. But when you're doing the book tour, you know, you're on your own. I put 5,700 miles on the car, driving from one bookstore to another. What was very enjoyable about it, particularly enjoyable, was that I had a chance to visit old friends basically at just about every city I stopped at, which was fun.
What are the reactions people come and to the book signings and such? Do they react to the mystery? They react to the classical music setting? What do they react to?
Well, you know, most book events are a combination of questions and answers, a little discussion about the book, a little bit of reading, and a little bit of book signing. What I brought to my book events, which were a little bit different, was that I brought my fiddle with me because all the books have to do with the world of classical music. In fact, all the titles are pieces of classical music that have to do with either death or the devil or something like that. And I would play some of the music from the books or arrangements of the music from the books. So that was a different twist on your usual book event. And I think that's what a lot of people responded to. This was off the beaten track a bit.
Yeah, that would be a twist. The author plays some music for you. In fact, on your website, GeraldElias.com, you have music that people can listen to from each of the novels. There's Devil's Trill, Dance Macabre, now Death and the Maiden.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that is something you'd like people to do as they're reading the book?
Oh, totally. In fact, you know, we had discussions with my publisher, St. Martin's Press, about whether it would be advisable to have a CD to go with the books, because that's what some of the readers had asked for. And I think the solution we came up with is even better, because you can just click on the website and hear a live performance of music from any of the books that I've written, performances that I've had the pleasure of participating in. And so it's free, it's easily accessible, and unlike a CD, you can't break it, you can't lose it, and you get the benefit of having the music from all the books and not just one at a time.
So you've had a career in classical music, and obviously there's story. In fact, in the author's note to this book, you estimate that you have at least 12 novels worth of stories from the world of classical music. Why mysteries? You could have written a lot of things about classical music. Why the mystery form?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. When I first wrote Devil's Trill, which is the first book in this series, it was originally intended primarily for violin students, and each chapter was going to be sort of a different lesson about things that young violinists have to confront, not only just playing the violin, but also things like how to prepare for auditions, how to find your way in the world of violin buying and selling, things like that. And so I wove a little story around it, but at one point, my agent said, you know, Jerry, you really have to decide what genre you want this book to be in, because if for no other reason, the bookstores need to know what shelf to put it on. And it was at that point that I decided to really make it a mystery, because when I was a kid, I have an older brother and sister, and my older brother had all the Hardy Boys adventures, and my sister had all the Nancy Drew mysteries. So ever since I was little, I was steeped in the lore of mysteries, and I've just always enjoyed reading them to this day, not just those Nancy Drew books, but mysteries in general. And I felt very comfortable writing in that genre, and that's what kind of made me decide to go that way.
Classical music world is a good setting for mystery. There's intrigue, there's pressure, there's jealousies, there's a lot of things going on in the world of classical music.
Yeah, you know, when most people go to a concert, you know, a symphony orchestra concert, for example, and see 100 musicians sitting there wearing tails and white ties and, you know, all the women in the elegant black gowns, it appears that everyone is pretty much the same. But then when you go behind the scenes and you get to meet people, get to know them, you'll see that there's a variety of personalities among musicians unlike no other profession. And in fact, you know, if anyone has played string quartets, you'll know that after a few years of playing string quartets with the same people, after a while, everyone wants to kill each other because the intensity of the experience is so great. So to me, it seemed like a perfect setting for a murder mystery.
And this book indeed is set with a quartet. Members are going missing. You have any? In fact, there's some elements here that are based, at least in part, or at least it has happened in real life.
You know, there's a tragic story of a real string quartet called the Audubon String Quartet, which made a name for itself in the 80s and early 90s. But they kind of self-destructed, as many string quartets do internally, because they played very, very well and had quite a good reputation. But similarly to my book, one of the musicians got fired, and he turned around and sued the other members of the quartet, and it went through the court system for several years of litigation, and finally the judge ruled in his favor, and the other musicians really had to sell their homes, sell their instruments, and for a classical musician, selling an instrument is almost like selling your own child. So it was pretty devastating. And the little personal twist in that story is that a couple years before they hired the violinist that eventually sued the group, I had auditioned for that very position. And looking back upon it, I just wonder how everyone's lives would have been different had the outcome of those auditions been different. Most likely I would never have ended up running these books, so I guess things turned out well for me anyway.
You talk about how, especially in a string quartet, there's pressure. There's a lot of pressure. Sometimes it comes out beautifully in the music. Sometimes it can destroy the quartet. Why so much pressure in a quartet?
Well, for one, the great composers very often turned to the genre of the string quartet to really communicate their deepest, most personal feelings, whether it's Beethoven or Schubert or Brahms. You know, some of their deepest, most profound music is in the string quartet. And as a result of that, the musicians who are involved in it are really drawn into it, and they themselves invest their total commitment into this music. And part of the difficulty of it is that every instrument is totally exposed. You hear every note that everyone's playing, so you have to play really perfectly as an individual. But at the same time, there has to be this unanimity of concept of the music. How, what kind of tone color you want, what kind of phrasing, what kind of articulation, and you can just go on down the list. So every note has to be carefully considered by all four members. And since there's so much invested personally in this music, each member really has strong feelings about how things should go. And that often leads to disagreements. And sometimes those disagreements are great because it's a creative process. But very often, those disagreements in the long run start to become personal and become very divisive. So it's a tough balancing act, and very few ensembles really get through that whole process intact.
And in that pressure cooker, the goal is to find a unified voice, right? And that
absolutely
takes a lot of work.
And that's really what distinguishes the great quartets from the others, quartets like the Guarneri or the Emerson String Quartet or the former Cleveland Quartet. I mean, they were just wonderful, wonderful ensembles and left a wonderful legacy.
So what makes a great quartet then? Some fall apart because they can't find that unified voice. The personalities, I guess, don't mesh. Others do.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, you need great musicians to be a great quartet, and there are a lot of good quartets, but to find that perfect match is very, very difficult. Arnold Steinhardt, who is the quartet of the former Guarneri String Quartet, likened playing in a quartet to being married to three other spouses. It really is that difficult, and to make things a success over a long period of time is really the ultimate challenge.
So tell me about the development of your central character, Daniel. Is it Jacobus?
Jacobus, yeah.
Jacobus.
Exactly.
How did he come about?
It's funny. He, of all the characters in the books, he, as the protagonist, I think, is not only the most complex, he's also the one that came most from my imagination and least from other people that I know. A lot of the characters are composites of people that I've known and worked with over the years. But Jacobus is a little bit different. And one of the questions I've been asked a lot is, why did I make him blind, which made it quite a bit of a challenge for me to write for, because in every scene or chapter that he's in, I try to describe what's going on in every means other than visual. So that made it tricky. But I made him blind for a couple of reasons. One is that, as is pretty commonly known, when someone loses a single of their senses, whether it's hearing or sight, their other senses become quite a bit more enhanced. And that's certainly true of Jacobus, because he has an extremely sophisticated sense of hearing, which aids him not only in music and makes him just a top-notch musician, but also in helping solve the mysteries, because he perceives things that others around him who are able to see are yet unable to perceive. So that's one reason I made him blind. And the other reason is more metaphorical. As you know from reading the books, Jacobus has turned his back on the classical music world because he feels that there have been compromises imposed upon the aesthetic perfection or aesthetic beauty of the music, things that kind of twist and turn the quality of the performance from something which is purely aesthetic to something which is more entertainment. So in a way, having him blind is metaphorical in the sense that he hears music on the level that he thinks music should be perceived, which is totally on an aural basis and not on a visual basis. So that, in a nutshell, kind of explains Jacobus. He has had quite a few tragedies in his life which has made him bitter, one of which was his blindness, but there are a couple other things in his past. So on the outside, he's very, very flinty and curmudgeonly, but on the inside, he still retains a heart of gold. And I have to relate a funny story that happened on one of my book tour stops. This one was in Albuquerque, where I introduced the readers to Jacobus by saying that he was a blind, over-the-hill, curmudgeonly violin teacher, at which point the manager of the store said, "So, Jerry, does that mean it's autobiographical?" And then he said, "Oh, of course not. You're not blind." So he got me twice in one line. So anyway, yeah, Jacobus is an interesting character, and some people just love him. And to tell you the truth, other people think he's just a little too crusty for their taste. But I kind of like him.
So you said of all of the characters, at least early on, he was the one most out of imagination and mm-hmm. least based on people you had known. Mm-hmm. Is there some of Jacobus in you? You and Jacobus?
Yeah, no doubt. I think there's a little Jacobus in a lot of musicians, because the issues that really get under his skin are the ones that a lot of musicians have to deal with day in and day out. You know, the kind of frustrations that come along with the job of playing in an orchestra or a quartet or even teaching. You know, so he gives voice to a lot of those frustrations and irritations that we experience all the time.
To what degree do you share his view that classical music in general has sort of gone to more entertainment and less deep artistic experience?
Well, you know, I share his view that it has. I'm not sure I share his view that there should be a total return to the way things used to be, you know, in the mid-20th century or before that, because our culture has changed so much. It's become much more fast-paced, much more visual, and a heck of a lot louder. So I think, you know, we need, without compromising the quality of the music we're making, I think we do need to consider what place it's going to have in our culture. My tendency is to kind of do away with the external distractions. I lean toward what Jacobus has to say in as far as that's concerned. But on the other hand, you know, if you've read Danse Macabre, we have this young African-American violinist who has pulled some of popular culture onto the concert stage, and that creates quite a bit of confrontation between him and the victim in Danse Macabre. And you know, I would not go to the extreme in that regard either. You know, we experimented in Utah Symphony some years back with what were called visual enhancements to our concerts, and I think that was kind of a dismal failure, and I'm glad they don't do that anymore, because you took some of the great masterpieces of Western music and you created, I would say, more distractions rather than enhancements. That being said, you know, there are a lot of pieces these days that are being composed for multimedia performance, and I think that's great because that makes it sort of an integrated process and really reflects the vision of the composer or the person producing it. So I'm kind of in the middle, but I lean toward Jacobus, mm-hmm. put it in a nutshell.
Just one more question on this point. I want to get into it, a few of the other characters. Interesting, you have some Russians here,
mm-hmm.
and some interesting settings, including in Peru. And I think you traveled to Peru.
Yeah.
From time to time, we'll get into that. But on the subject of general classical music, it seems like even some of the more prestigious classical organizations need to look at the bottom line, and so perhaps it's just my perception, you have more sort of greatest hits of classical programs,
mm-hmm.
and fewer of the maybe the you know the, what you might call the deeper artistic programs. I don't know if you see a trend there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a really tough balancing act, because if on one hand you play only the war horses, people are going to get tired of it sooner or later. On the other hand, if your mix contains a lot of contemporary music that is hard to to access either intellectually or emotionally, you know, that becomes difficult also. In times of difficult economic as you say, bottom lines, the tendency has been to sort of retrench into traditional programming. And, you know, I can understand that, though I think it really is important to continue to play new music, or at least music that isn't heard that often, because it really is a creative process, not only for the musicians, but for the audience as well. And as much as I love Beethoven symphonies or Brahms or any of the great 19th century composers, I still think for my own musical development, I need to occasionally play new music, even if I don't particularly care for it. I think it's really important to do. And another reason that it's important is that we need to find new great composers just to keep this tradition going.
What do you hope your students get from the music, whether they have a career in this or not? What do you hope to transmit to your students?
Now, one of the great things about learning an instrument is that it not only deepens one's aesthetic appreciation of culture, it develops one's physical gifts, the small motor skills, which are so important in a lot of activities. And it also benefits one's mental discipline, because the degree of concentration and attention to detail that one needs in learning an instrument and in learning music, I think benefits just about any endeavor that one ends up going into. So that the kind of music education, which unfortunately we now do not have in public schools, really is something that I think is vitally important, even if one considers that, you know, even among conservatory students or music performance majors and colleges. Only about 1% of those people actually end up as performing musicians. It's still incredibly important, in my opinion.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Gerald Elias, who has been a Boston Symphony violinist, associate concertmaster of the Utah Symphony, adjunct professor of music at University of Utah, first violinist of the Abramian String Quartet, and music director of the Vivaldi Candlelight Concert Series. He's author of three books now in the Daniel Jacobus Mystery Series, Devil's Trill, which was selected by Barnes & Noble for the 2009 Discover Great New Writers catalog, and Danse Macabre, hailed as one of the top five mysteries in 2010 by Library Journal. Now, Death and the Maiden, the book is available. It's set with a string quartet, the new Magini String Quartet. The former second violinist has sued the ensemble and issued an ultimatum, and in the meantime, the first violinist is unaccountably missing in action, and that launches us into the plot. We'll get more into Death and the Maiden and talk much more about music and about mysteries with Gerald Elias following this break.
Today's Access Utah program was first broadcast in October of 2011. Gerald Elias, for latest novel in the Jacob Jacobus Mystery Series titled Death and Transfiguration, will be published in June. And now Ed Casilia with an essay.
It's good to be king, but it's better to be mom, especially in Mexico. Mother's Day is probably the most celebrated non-religious holiday around the globe. A lot of dinero is spent here on cards, flowers, dinners, gifts, you name it, as Mexico celebrates Día de las Madres, Mother's Day, which is always celebrated here on May 10th. Although things are changing a bit, Mexican culture usually views the father as the ruler of the family and the mother as its heart. Now, more often than not, my wife assumes both places in our household, but that's only because she has more common sense and wisdom. Día de las Madres is a big deal. They love their fathers here, don't get me wrong, but moms, they are venerated. One of the things I've noticed since moving here is the importance of family. We've gone to many fiestas in the plaza and seen entire families gathered for the festivities. If one of the children participates in the celebration, the whole bunch shows up to lend support. Truthfully, I don't think babysitters make a lot of money down here. Kids are a part of everything. Día de las Madres is a Yankee import. It began here in 1922 when newspaperman Rafael Alducin wrote an article advocating the celebration of Mother's Day in all of Mexico. Moms had already been given an elevated status in Mexican culture. This simply ensured their place with a holiday dedicated specifically to them. Because Mother's Day is a fixed date, May 10th, it most frequently lands on a weekday. That doesn't dampen the celebration, however. Schools will often offer skits or plays and invite the local moms to attend. Many employees will buy breakfast or lunch for moms who have to work that day. In the early 1940s, shopkeepers who were members of the Party of the Mexican Revolution opened their doors to women from the lower economic strata who were allowed to come into their stores on Mother's Day and take home a free gift. In the early 1940s, they were allowed to go to the pawn shops and reclaim their prized sewing machines at no cost. Traditionally, sons and daughters returned to the family home on the night before Mother's Day. The next morning, children will stand outside the home and serenade their moms with the song Las Mañanitas. Expatriate moms like my wife, well, they get to celebrate Mother's Day twice, once on May 10th, then again the second Sunday in May, the traditional day in the United States. And why not? I know how much work it takes to be a mom. I see how much love they give to their families. I see how they are our heart, soul, our moral compass. You know, somehow even 2 days isn't enough to celebrate all that moms do for us. Happy Mother's Day, Kara, Mom, and the rest of you fabulous women. We'd be lost without you. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for staying with us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have another half with Gerald Elias, who's author of Death and the Maiden. It's a Daniel Jacobus mystery set in the world of classical music. Previously, Mr. Elias was author of Devil's Trill, selected by Barnes & Noble for their 2009 Discovered Great New Writers catalog, and Danse Macabre, hailed as one of the top five mysteries in 2010 by Library Journal. Gerald Lias is a former Boston Symphony violinist and I believe still plays, you said, Summers at Tanglewood?
Even after leaving Boston Symphony to come to Utah, I maintained a relationship with them, and on those occasions where they're in need of additional violinists for the summer, they give me a call, and we have a little cottage out in the woods near Tanglewood, so we often spend summers there, which is a lovely place to be.
Oh, wonderful. Gerald Lias, also a former associate concertmaster of the Utah Symphony, also adjunct professor of music, University of Utah, first violinist of the Abramian String Quartet, which had a run of about 10 years, I think.
And
music director of Vivaldi Candlelight Concert Series. And so along with his teaching and his music, now writing these mystery novels, Death and the Maiden is set with a string quartet, the new Magini String Quartet. They're performing for a performance of Schubert's masterpiece, Death and the Maiden. They hope it'll resuscitate their career. And a former second violinist has sued the ensemble when he was fired and publicly embarrassed. And the manipulative first violinist, Aaron Kartovsky, is unaccountably missing in action. By the way, he's described as manipulative. You were first violinist. I don't know. I doubt you were manipulative. Is that something?
Of course not.
But that's good. There could be perhaps a perception out there that the first violinist sort of could be perceived as star of the show. Are there divas out there, so called?
Well, you know, there certainly are, and of course, it's not just with string quartets. It's with not only every art form, but you find them in just about any enterprise, from business to athletics as well. But certainly the ones we often see are the opera singers or the ballet dancers or once in a while the concert soloists. But string quartets are a little bit different. I think it's more of a democracy in string quartets, though, you know, from time to time, there are those where one of the musicians really dominates, and this is one of those cases.
I'd like to read a passage, if you would. I think you have your book with you.
Sure.
Just the beginning, the chapter number one, which is titled One. So that first page and then over through the end of the middle paragraph on page six.
Okay.
If you would.
So from the prologue, is that where you'd like me to read? Chapter one.
Yeah, chapter one, yeah.
Okay.
This sort of sets up the action, and it kind of paints a nice picture. It's set at Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll just start reading, and you tell me when to quit.
Okay.
Okay. Hearing the tepid applause as the maestro du jour sauntered onto the Tanglewood stage, Jacobus relegated the lawsuit to the back of his mind. He was among the sparse, haggard crowd that braved the damp chill to hear the Boston Symphony's next-to-last outdoor concert of the summer season, a Saturday night performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, a piece of music that he often turned to for life-affirming reassurance in moments of personal despair. More than a work of uncompromising genius, it was the most compelling clarion call to universal brotherhood in all of music. But as he sat shivering under the relentless frozen mist that lashed through the open-sided Tanglewood shed, the overwhelming restless energy of the first movement served only to make him feel insignificant by comparison. Insignificant and mortally fragile, like a leaf in autumn. Unlike the millions of tourists who came to New England, Jacobus, blind, was unable to revel in the stunning brilliance of the impending fall foliage. The mental visualization of red, orange, and yellow, long lost to his mind's eye, was replaced by the decaying smell of moldering leaves, thickening day by day in layers under his slowing footstep, a harbinger of an eternal winter. He was a leaf, one of the thousands of leaves on one maple among thousands of maples, his vitality slowly but inexorably sapping, tenuously fixed to its mooring until even the most inconsequential puff of air would separate him from his station and blow him brown and lifeless to the frozen ground to be covered by the snow. Jacobus put his hands in his pockets. The violinist's fingertips must be stinging like hell in this cold, he thought, as the driving intensity of the music built to the defiant recapitulation of the first movement, especially the ones who had developed deep grooves from years of pressing the strings too hard. Jacobus laughed as he recalled one cold August night back when he was still in the orchestra. Sal Maggiolo, who was from the Amalfi Coast, had played with gloves on, the fingertips of the left glove cut off so he could still feel the strings. It was the most obscenity-laced Haydn symphony Jacobus had ever played.
Okay, we'll leave it there. It gives you a nice picture of Tanglewood, some of the thoughts that Jacobus has, introduces a theme that will be brought up in, of course, the music that the quartet is rehearsing, Death and the Maiden. And interesting insight into what musicians go through. I guess when we're sitting in a concert, we sometimes don't think about the cold or the heat or and what that does to the musicians.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you play an outdoor summer season, as the Utah Symphony does or as the Boston Symphony does, facing the elements is just one added feature of the, the performance. Mm-hmm. And especially at Tanglewood, you never know if it's going to be 90 degrees and 99% humidity or whether it's going to be a frost at the end of the summer.
Tell me a little about Tanglewood. There's a lot of history here. A lot of us have never been. This is an outdoor venue, right?
Yeah, it's an outdoor venue, but the stage and about 5,000 seats are covered with a roof, though it is open-sided. And behind the name of the concert hall is called The Shed. Behind The Shed is a huge lawn, so when we have big concerts, whether it's Beethoven Ninth or James Taylor or Yo-Yo Ma or Itzhak Perlman, they're usually about another 10,000 people out on the lawn. So they're quite big audiences there if you keep your fingers crossed and the weather is good.
The next paragraph I didn't have you read talks about a young Englishman, a new maestro, has some kind of a reputation, but the musicians aren't that inspired. They're just sort of trying to do their best. And this is one of those instances where I wanted to know who exactly you're talking about. Of course, you're probably not going to reveal that, but you've had both experiences, I imagine, conductors who greatly inspired you and conductors who you had to sort of play around.
Well, I wasn't speaking of anyone in particular there. That was just a total figment of my imagination. But we do have the entire range of conductors, you know, from great geniuses to people who really need to do some more studying. And I would say that the musicians in Utah Symphony are very polite to new conductors, guest conductors, and bend over backwards to do their best. There are other orchestras where if someone comes and really isn't up to snuff, they'll give the conductor a much more difficult time just to send a message. But in the end, I think when it comes time to the performance, everyone puts their best hat on and does the best they can. Sometimes it's in spite of the conductor, and sometimes it's because of the conductor.
Yeah. The quartet's a different thing. It's more of a democracy, right? You all have to play together. There's only four, so.
Right, yeah. And, unlike an orchestra in which most of the string players' sound is pretty anonymous, when you're playing a string quartet, every sound you make is heard by the entire audience. So you really have to be on top of your game all the time with a string quartet. I think that's one reason why it's so easy to burn out.
Mm. That opening passage that had you read already introduces, you have the falling leaves. Jacobus can't see the brilliant leaves, but he can smell the decay of the leaves. He's thinking about this. And Death and the Maiden treats this philosophically. Should one resist death, you write in the author's note? Should one bow gracefully to the inevitable? Tell us a little bit about this music.
Well, Death and the Maiden is the name of a string quartet by Schubert. It's one of the greatest in the entire literature. It's about 45, 50 minutes long, and it's of almost relentless intensity and dark energy. And any string quartet that makes a name for itself, of course, has that in its repertoire. The quartet itself was taken from a song that Schubert had written a couple of years before that by the same name, Death and the Maiden. Unlike the quartet, though, it's only about 2.5 minutes long, and it's in two stanzas. In the first stanza, we hear the voice of a young maiden who, in just a couple of brief phrases, tells the specter of death that he should leave her alone, that she's too young to be taken, and that he should just go away. The second stanza is the voice of death responding, saying, I'm not here to harm you. I'm going to be very gentle, and please just take my hand and rest peacefully in my arms. And that's how the song ends. It really is kind of left up in the air, and the music is extremely moving and profound. And I think the message itself is universal because it kind of makes us ask the question, when it is our time, when we're confronted by death, should we resist? Should we struggle to continue to breathe for another minute or hour or day? Or should we just resign ourselves and go into the night? And that becomes a theme of the book. And there are these struggles, not just within the string quartet, but among other characters in the book, not excluding Jacobus himself. So, you know, even though the book is a traditional murder mystery with quite a bit of humor intertwined in it, it still has a serious message to be told, I think.
If you just joined us, we're spending the hour with Gerald Elias. He's a graduate of Yale. He's been a Boston Symphony violinist, associate concertmaster of Utah Symphony, adjunct professor of music, University of Utah, first violinist of the Abramian Street Quartet, among other bullet points on his resume. And he is now author of 3 Daniel Jacobus mystery novels.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned some very nice things about the success of the first couple of books.
Yes.
But just recently, Danse Macabre was selected as Book of the Year in Fiction by the Utah Humanities Council.
Oh, excellent. Congratulations.
Yeah, so I was very honored that they selected that book among many, many wonderful books by Utah authors.
So the books are Devil's Trill, Danse Macabre, and now Death and the Maiden. And we have another 10 minutes left with Gerald Elias. You have the music up on the website, by the way, GeraldElias.com, and so I could see how this would fit an ad to your enjoyment of the book. You read about the rehearsal process, and of course the themes are running through the book, Schubert's Death and the Maiden. The other selections here, Beethoven's String Quartet, Opus 59, Number 3. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that is one of the most exciting string quartets ever written, especially the finale, which just is a whirlwind of energy. One of the criticisms that Beethoven encountered throughout his life was from the academic wing of composers in Europe, which was that he wasn't capable of writing a good fugue. So he took just about every opportunity he could to disprove that. And this last movement of the Beethoven Quartet is one of the most amazing and fastest fugues ever written. And it almost inevitably brings audiences to their feet. And that is it's a real virtuoso string quartet piece. And that's one of the things that in my book, The Numagini String Quartet, performed when it was on its concert tour, and if I remember correctly, was the final piece on the program, after which the first violinist disappeared.
And Smetana's From My Life.
Mm-hmm. You know, all these quartets are some of the favorites that we had as the Abramian String Quartet. So whenever you mention any of these quartets, it brings back incredibly fond memories. And I must say that after 10 years of playing together with my three colleagues who are still in the Utah Symphony, we started as good friends, and we ended up as good friends and made wonderful music in between, which not a lot of quartets can say that. Mm. So I feel very fortunate to have played with them, and it was a great experience. But the Smetana Quartet is quite a unique piece of music because he wrote it right near the end of his life at a time when he knew he was dying, when he had lost, he had become blind himself, Smetana, and he was a national hero, and because he brought Czech national music to the concert stage, and when he wrote this quartet, he looked back upon all the wonderful success he had, and at the same time, all the turmoil in his life. So every movement in the quartet is autobiographical, up to and including the end of the quartet where he foresees his own death. Because at the end of his life, because of his illness, he had this constant, extremely high-pitched E-natural in his head that he just could not turn off, and it was literally driving him crazy. And at the end of this quartet, right at the climax of his greatest success, you hear all of a sudden the first violinist play this shrieking high E natural, and it really is spine tingling.
Hmm.
Great piece of music.
And you can hear these again. It's GeraldElias.com. I believe these performances are the Abramian String Quartet.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah, yeah, so you can hear that right on my website.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about the Russian characters. You have some Russian characters here. Where did that come from?
Over the course of the years, from the time I joined the Boston Symphony in 1975, I have had the great good fortune of meeting a lot of Russian musicians, either in the orchestra or conductors or teachers. And without exception, they all have great stories to tell and tell them in a uniquely wonderful way. There's something about Russian musicians that is extremely engaging, not only in a musical sense, but in a very personal sense. You might recall that for several years, we had a principal guest conductor here, Pavel Kogan, who was quite a fine musician and quite a character. And for many years, the Utah Symphony was blessed with the violist in the orchestra, Misha Bogoslavsky, who was one of the founding members of the Moscow Chamber Orchestra. And one never gets tired of listening to Russians telling stories. And I just used some of them. Of course, I changed them around to fit the book, but we have this Russian emigre string quartet in the book, the original Magini string quartet. Some people have told me that they have found some of the characters in the book to be almost verging on being a caricature. But if you met some of these musicians that I have, you'd realize that they really are for real. I'm very proud of those characters in the book.
And in the new Magini Quartet, the first violinist, Aaron Kortovsky, the only remaining original member, the original Magini Quartet is Pravda Linskaya, and there are other Russian characters. Just have a couple of minutes left, I want to conclude with your central character, Daniel Jacobus.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine in each book you are concerned with moving his story forward. You don't want him to just be static.
Right. Well, you know, that was one of the challenges, because when I first wrote Devil's Trill, it wasn't clear yet that this was going to be a series. But the publisher liked the story and particularly liked the character of Daniel Jacobus. But I think in order to make things believable and to avoid keeping the books from becoming static, I really had to develop an entire life story for the guy. And as we go from one book to the next, you learn a little bit more about him in each book. In fact, the fourth book of the series, which is called Death and Transfiguration, and you're going to learn a lot more about him in that book. That being said, it's not a sequential kind of series, so you don't need to read the first book in order to enjoy the second or the third. You can really read them in any order you want, because all the plots are totally different.
Anything you'd like to say about Death and Transfiguration?
Well, I will say it's the one that all my orchestral colleagues have been waiting for, because it's the one where the conductor gets murdered.
The conductor gets murdered.
Yeah, the conductor gets murdered in that one. It's about a very powerful kind of traditional maestro in the tradition of Toscanini or Fritz Reiner or George Zell or someone like that, someone who makes great music, but whose personality leaves something to be desired. So creates a lot of enemies, and the question, of course, is who done it?
The current book is Death and the Maiden, and that's out now. Gerald Elias, author previously of Devil's Trill and Danse Macabre. And he has been a Boston Symphony Violinist, Associate Concertmaster of Utah Symphony, Adjunct Professor of Music, University of Utah, First Violinist of the Brahmian String Quartet, and now author of this series. And it's been a pleasure, Gerald Elias, to have you for the hour.
And for me, too. Thanks so much.
And the website is GeraldElias.com. You can hear that music as you read the books. Thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Today's Access Utah program was first broadcast in October 2011. Gerald Elias' latest novel in the Daniel Jacobus mystery series, entitled Death and Transfiguration, will be published in June.